I had had Craig lead that song because I want us to focus this morning on the need to put on the armor of God. And the reason we need to do that is because we have a great enemy. And we're going to talk a little bit about that enemy for a few minutes. And then we're going to talk about the God that can give us victory over that enemy. And I was just thinking about that again. You know, when Debbie was just baptized. And immediately after you're baptized, I think is one of the times that some of the greatest tests come, because that's when the devil's kind of lost someone who belonged to him. And he's going to try to get you back. I just remember when Jesus was baptized, the first place he went, as soon as he left the waters, was out into the wilderness to face the devil. And so he knows what we go through. And but what I want to do for us just a minute is I want you to think about the devil. Because he is somebody that we need to fear. We need to be afraid. I don't know if I should say that, but I'm afraid of the devil. He scares me to death. God paints all kinds of pictures for us of him in the Bible. One's of a dragon in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 3. He paints a picture of him as a lion, a roaring lion, just looking for somebody he can eat alive in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 9. And then back at the beginning he appears as a snake, as a crafty, cunning snake. And then in Ephesians, in the passage that was just read a minute ago, we find out that he's none of those things in terms of flesh, but he's a spiritual force, which makes him even, in a sense, more dangerous. Because it's somebody, not just that you can't see, but the fact that he is not flesh and blood. We are flesh and blood, and so he is more powerful than us. He is someone that we need to fear. We cannot beat him on our own. And that's what that last song was kind of about. But I think, you know, and one of the passages in Revelation that really features his defeat, but has a passage, a verse in it that I just want you to think about. He says, "Woe to those inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath," in Revelation 12 and verse 12. He is a beaten tyrant. God has beaten him, but he is still free, and he has got a vengeance, and he is after us. And I want us to take the first few minutes and just, I guess, we don't see him literally every day. We don't see him appear before us some kind of form of a dragon or a lion or a snake, or we'd be running. But we may not take him as seriously as we should because of that. And so I want us to take a few minutes this morning and just take look at some of the glimpses of the devil where he appears different times throughout the Bible. And he'll just appear there and then he disappears. I mean, I may leave a couple out because of time, but I just put several in there. And then at the end, I want us to look at some encouraging things that he is not one that we have to be overcome by, that we have the arsenal necessary to win. But let's start with the first part, that the devil is one to be feared. And the one I want you to think about is Judas and the devil. John chapter 12, you might remember that Judas loved money. He loved money so much that we find out he was stealing it. Chapter 6, and we'll look at chapter 13 in just a second, but in chapter 12 and verse 6 of John, you remember Jesus said, got on to Judas because he was criticizing the lady who was using the oil to anoint Jesus' feet. And Jesus said that he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief and he had the money box and he used to pilfer, that's like skim off the top, what was put in it. You know, that's kind of like putting your head in the lion's mouth, wasn't it? To assume responsibility for the money box when you know you got a problem with loving money. I mean, that probably was the last thing that Judas should have been doing. And when the Pharisees offered him money to turn Jesus over to them, the devil was there. And so in chapter 13 there, in verse 2, it says, "And during the supper, the Last Supper, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus began to wash the feet of people after that." So the devil was there. He's already put it in his heart to betray him. And then later in that same chapter, in verse 29, Jesus, it says, for some were supposing because Judas had the money box that Jesus was saying to him, buy the things that we need, have need of for the feast, or else that he should give something to the poor. And after receiving the morsel, he went out immediately, and it was night. But there's a passage right there that says that the devil entered into him. Where is that at? I just didn't write that one down. It's got to be right there. verse 27. And after the morsel, Satan entered into him. And Jesus said, do what you do quickly. So he's there. He was at the supper. We need to see him. And Judas gave in to his appetites. And his appetite was for money. And so Satan was ready to take advantage of that. And whatever our appetites are, whether they're for money, or whether it's recognition, or whether it's passion, or whether it's substances like alcohol or cigarettes or whatever, or drugs, or whether it's for respect, that is the devil's opportunity. That is his opportunity. And just like God said to Cain, sin is crouching at the door, and you must master it. That day, Judas got eaten by a lion because he had not mastered his appetites. And he is out there. And he's ready to take us that same way if we're not careful. Another is the devil and his demons. He appears that way too. So a lot of references to that. I just picked one in Luke chapter 8. There are a lot of stories of demon possession in the New Testament. I think God gave Satan special permission for a period of time. And verse 27, he took control of people. He took control of people. Verse 27. And when he had come out onto the land, that is Jesus, he was met by a certain man from the city who was possessed with demons, and who had not put on any clothing for a long time. And he was not living in a house, but in the tombs. And down in verse 29, it says, for he had been commanding the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times. He was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would burst his fetters and be driven by the demon into the desert or into lonely places. When the devil had that opportunity to operate in such an intense way, he took control of people. He would make them into his slaves. And under his control, they had horrible behavior. And they even forgot who they were. And while he may not have permission today to go that far, at least I don't believe he does, nevertheless, do you see him? Can you see him? He is a dragon. He is ruthless. He is not kind. He is not gentle. He is not merciful. He will control you and ruin you completely. And he will make you forget who you are. And sometimes it just blows my mind when we hang a welcome sign on the door and give him permission to come in, and think that he won't do the same thing to us that he's done to people in ages past. He also showed up another time. Remember Herod, King Herod? He was jealous. Matthew 2 and verse 16, we don't have to turn and read that one, but he was jealous at the announcement or the finding out that there was a new king that had potentially been born. Because Herod coveted power. And he had soldiers, and he sent those soldiers into the town of Bethlehem to kill all the babies, 2 years young, 2 years old and younger. Killed them all. Can't imagine. And Herod is not the only one that was concerned about the birth of that new king. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 4 and 5 tells us that while you may not see him in the Gospels where he was, where we have the story of Herod doing that, committing those crimes of atrocity. In chapter 12, when he does appear, the dragon, it says in verse 4, his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven. He threw them to the earth. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with the rod of iron. There was a spot there where the devil wasn't visible. At least Matthew didn't tell about him. But he's there. He's behind the scenes. And the devil may not have understood all of God's plan, I don't think, at that moment. But it seems that he's aware of who that child is, and he is afraid of somebody who will take away his rule from him. He was afraid of that child because he knew that child came to rule. So when I look at the devil who sort of appears in this place, it tells me that he will work through us when we become like Herod. That we're afraid of losing our power. You have some management, some degree of power that you've been granted. Somebody's given you some kind of privileged power that you have. But when we feel threatened, we think that's our power somehow. And we act in ungodly ways to eliminate some threat, whether that's in the home, or whether that's in a business, or whether that's in a church. He's there. You may not see him, but he's there and he's at work. And he's a lion, and he will eat us alive if that's our problem. And then there's another place, I think the Pharisees and the devil, that he was behind them too. Mark chapter 4, verse 15. You don't see him, but I think he's there. Mark chapter 4, verse 15, Jesus told a parable about the sower. It goes out, sows the seed, throws it on all across the ground. Depending on the kind of soil it lands on, determines the kind of crop that grows. But some of that seed fell on the wayside or the paths that people walked on. And when he interprets that parable and says what it means, in verse 15, he said, the sower sows the word, and there are the sons, there are the ones who are beside the road. That is, these are the ones, the seed beside the road, where the word is sown. And when they hear, immediately Satan comes and takes away the word which has been sown in them. And certainly, you know, it's that hard soil that's impenetrable. The seed can't get in because it's beaten down and it's packed. And before it ever penetrates to do any good in the soil, the devil is right there to take it away. And at least one of the applications, one of the groups of people that it fit very well in the first century were the religious leaders. They wouldn't listen to Jesus. They rejected what he said. And so they never were able to benefit from the word that he gave them because the devil was right there because of that hard heart. And he seized it and he took it away. You know, and they were proud. And they thought they knew everything. And they liked their traditions. And they didn't like somebody coming in and telling them something that they didn't like. And so I think when a person is stubborn, when he's obstinate, when I'm in that mood and I won't let the word penetrate, when we won't listen to other people that are trying to help us and give us some advice, some good godly counsel, the devil's there. And he will steal away the wisdom that God is offering us. He'll steal it away. Check your heart. Just a great... How many times have we, you know, do people fall because we don't check our hearts? Don't keep them... And we let them get hardened. And we're stubborn and we won't listen. But he shows up another time too. He shows up at the very beginning. I didn't put these in order because I didn't want you to be able to anticipate which one was next. Genesis chapter 3. You know, Jesus called the devil the father of liars, I think in John chapter 8. And when we first get introduced to him in the garden, find that's exactly what he is. And so the serpent, verse 1, was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, from the trees of the garden we may eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be open. You will be like God, knowing good and evil. You know, I used to think that would have been have that snake approach, you would have been pretty frightening. Because I hate snakes. I really don't like things. But you know what? If you just had a lion come by and some of these other predators, that little snake that shows up, he probably looked fairly harmless, don't you think? I mean, I wonder if that wasn't the reason he came in that form. I mean, I've been taught to fear snakes and run from them. But, you know, in the garden, that probably didn't look too ferocious. But that was his nature. He was cunning and he was crafty and he was subtle, the way he approached them. And he lied to her. And some of the lies he will tell. He will lie to you and he will convince you that God has taken away all your fun. You know, he's taken away all of your fun. Didn't God say to you, he says to Eve, that you couldn't eat from any tree in the garden? Well, that was a lie. God said you could eat from every tree in the garden except one. But you tweak that just a little bit, it makes it sound like God's taking away all your fun. Can't do anything if you serve Him. And He'll lie and He'll tell you that God won't do what He says. You know, God says if we touch that fruit, if we eat of it, we're going to die. And He says you won't die. And He'll lie and He'll tell you that God's not giving you the things that you have a right to. You know, God knows that if you take that, you're going to be just like Him. You're going to have wisdom. You're going to be just like God. He's keeping back from you something you ought to have. Liar. But she bought into it. He lies. And so when He appears at the very beginning, He's sort of kind of introduced to him as a great liar. So be careful that we don't buy into his lies. He tells us just exactly what we want to hear. He shows up another time in the book of Job. Job chapter 1. Turn over there. Job chapter 1. Job was probably a patriarch as well. He lived probably back in the time of Abraham and maybe even around the time of Noah. Who knows? He was back in that early part of the Bible. Early part of man's history. And interestingly, we get a perspective on how the devil thinks. And in Job, you know, God holds Job up before the devil. At least during that time, the devil was permitted to come into God's presence. And he says, look at my servant Job. There's nobody more righteous in the land. Nobody. Job is the man. He is the model of the kind of man that I wanted people to be like. And Satan responds, he retorts to that in verse 9 and 10. And he says, to the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he'll surely curse you to his face. And the devil says, well, you know, why wouldn't he serve you? The only reason, you give him everything. You made him rich. You give him livestock. You give him a nice family, all these children. Why would the guy not? He's got all kinds of fame. He's well known as the greatest man in the East. Why would he not serve you? The only reason he does that is for what he's getting out of it. You're kind of buying his service. That's why he serves you. And God says, well, all right, take it away. The point was, he wanted to show that he didn't believe that about Job. He believed that Job served him because of who he was, because he loved God. So he permitted that those blessings to be taken away. And Job proved that he really did love God for who he was. And then when he doesn't get him on that, he uses Job's lack of awareness of what God was doing to convince him God was against him. He tries another tactic. He says, through Job's friends, he says, listen, Job's suffering. He's lost everything. He's lost his health. He's lost his family. And his friends say, listen, bad things like this just don't happen to people who are good. You must have done something bad. That's why God's punishing you. And that's really what almost broke him. Because the thing Job cherished more than anything else was a relationship with God. And the idea that maybe God was against him and that he had lost that relationship was really what really just, I think, escalated and challenged Job's faith more than anything. But have you ever seen someone, so you see the devil's tactics. Have you ever seen someone fall away because they lose a lot of things that they have? You know, and they kind of prove the devil right. That the only reason maybe that person served God in the first place was because of what he gave them. You know, somebody loses someone that's dear to them, or they lose their job, or they lose their health, and then they just, I'm done with God. And you wonder, is that why they served God to begin with? Just because? Did he win there? You say, yeah, that is true. Some people just serve God because of what he gives them. And I think, what would happen to me? You know, what would happen? What would happen to us? Think about yourself. What if God permitted the devil to take away something from you? Maybe he has. Maybe certainly people have lost things. Maybe here. Things that are precious to you. Maybe a family member. Maybe a child. maybe a job, maybe your house, and some things. Maybe you lost some things that are. Did it rock your world? Did it shake your faith? Did you leave God because of that? I mean, certainly, if he tried that tactic on Job, he'll try it again today. And whenever things are going really bad things are really hard and everybody seems against you and all that, do you ever think, I must be doing something wrong. God must not like me anymore. He must not love me because look at how hard things are for me. Just see that he is working and he is going to use whatever tactics he can to try to draw us away. And then there's Peter and the devil. Look if you would at Luke 22. Remember, just before Jesus was arrested, he tried to get everybody ready, tried to prepare people, prepare his apostles for that when he was arrested. And we don't see the devil visibly here, but we know he's there because Jesus is warning Peter. And he says in chapter 22 and verse 30, or verse 31, he says, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded," or obtained, in my marginal version, my margin it says, "obtained permission to sift you like wheat. But I prayed for you." I don't know, I try to think of a modern day illustration of sifting somebody like wheat. I didn't have a flour sifter, I would have brought it and run you through the mill. Run you through the ringer. I think those are still all kind of old. He's going to grind you up like powder. He wants to grind you up. And so you can say there's a lion nearby, and he wants to eat you alive. He is a real being. He is a force, not just some kind of evil force. I mean, he is real. He's a personality. What should Peter have said? What should his reply have been under those circumstances? Maybe something like, "I am afraid. That scares me to death. Can you tell me what to do? Can you help me? Can you deliver me from this? Help me. I'm afraid." But he doesn't do that. That's not his response. Instead, he said, "Lord, I'm ready to go both to prison and to death with you." Verse 33. And he says, "Peter." He says, Peter, "a cock's not going to crow today until you deny me three times." And then Peter, in Mark's account, he says, "There's not a chance in the planet. I wouldn't do that. I'm not going to deny you." I don't know what drove that in Peter. Maybe it was pride. Maybe he was just kind of reckless, kind of impetuous. Peter speaking before he thought. Maybe he wanted to assure Jesus that he could be counted on. "You can count on me." But the devil spotted a weakness in Peter that Peter didn't perceive, I think, about himself. And sometimes he probably gets us on the same ground. Maybe whether it's our pride or our ego, or whether we don't see in ourselves the weakness that he sees. We don't ask for instructions. We won't listen. We boldly rush in and do things carelessly. But he's always there. And he's looking for our weakness that he can capitalize on it. And then I have two more, but I think I'm going to skip the last one for the sake of time. This one was interesting. David and the devil. One spot that appeared that was interesting. 1 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 1. David, Satan provoked David to number the people, to take a census. 1 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 1. Says, "Then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So David said to Joab and the princes of the people, 'Go and number Israel from Beersheba to Dan. Bring me a word that I may know their number.' And Joab said, 'May the Lord add to his people 100 times as many as they are. But Lord, they're not all. Are they not all the Lord's servants? Why does my Lord seek this thing? Why should it be a cause of guilt?'" Peter was David's way out. Joab said, "Don't do that. That's not a good idea. You don't need to number the people of Israel. Yeah, there are plenty." But David wanted to know the size of his fighting force. And he got that number. After about 9 months, it came back and there was 1,300,000. You learn that in 2 Samuel 24. And Joab, but Joab said, don't do this, you don't need to, we have God on our side. But David insisted on that census being taken. Samuel adds to that in 2 Samuel 24 and verse 1, and he says God incited David to number Israel. So that's interesting that in Chronicles he says that Satan incited David to do it, and in Samuel chapter 24 and verse 1, 2 Samuel 24 and 1, that God incited David to do it. The way I understand that is that God saw what David wanted to do, and it was evil. But David was determined to do what he wanted. And so Samuel said, God incited him to do it. Go ahead then. If that's what you want to do, then you go ahead and do it. Number the people. Was Satan involved? Yep. Was God involved? Yep. Does God tempt man? He does not. The Bible says he does not tempt us. But he is not obligated to restrain us from evil when we are dead set on doing what we know is wrong and we want to do it. The devil got David that day, and it cost over 70,000 lives before it was over. And then, I'm not going to do the one with Jesus and the devil. We know that situation in the wilderness when he was tempted by the devil there. But he shows up at different places in history. And I just want you to see some snapshots in time where the devil appears. And my family said, you can't stop this sermon at that point. You got to give him some encouragement after that. So, the last thing. What do we do? Well, the first thing, we need to draw near to God. In Ephesians chapter 6, I'm just going to put these up here for you. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. So that we that God has given us this armor. And we better put it on. We better draw near to Him when we look at the dangerous nature of our adversary. Finally, my brethren, be strong where? In the Lord. And in the power of His might. And put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. And he goes on to say, because the devil is more than flesh and blood. In other words, we cannot defeat him on our own. Put on the whole armor of God so that you may be able, it says. It implies if we don't, we will not be able to defeat him. The song Soldiers of Christ Arise talks about the panoply of God. I used to think that was canopy of God. I was like, I never could get that. I couldn't for years. Like, what does that mean? A panoply is like an arsenal. It's like the allies that you have. And the panoply of God that's presented in this text is you have God, you have the Son, you have the Spirit, you have the sword, which is the Word. In the book itself, in Ephesians, you have angels that are part of the panoply. You have brethren that will help you. You got a great arsenal of allies that God has given us to win this battle. It's more than sufficient, as our song was, to overcome the devil. All of the fiery darts of the evil one, Ephesians tells us. So we need to draw near to God. I tell you what, we better get closer to God than we ever have before, because he is a dangerous enemy, the devil is. The second thing is that we need to learn to trust in God and not in ourselves. Somebody says, well, aren't we supposed to fight him? Aren't we supposed to resist the devil? Yes, we are. James says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. But Paul said, and I like this passage in 2 Thessalonians 3. He says, but the Lord is faithful, who will establish you and guard you from the evil one. Whose part do you think is greater? Mine or God's? Well, the ratio is something like 7-1. I have a part to play, but it's not me that really ends up, I think, winning the battle. And I have one quick illustration that I really like too. Look real quickly to Genesis chapter 20, verse 5 and 6. I remember when Abraham, one of his less faithful decisions, took his wife Sarah and went on a journey to the land of the Negev, and he settled between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in a place called Gerar. And in that place, Abimelech, who was the king there, took away his wife, as had happened already one time previously in Egypt. And God came to Abimelech in a dream, and he said, "You're a dead man, because you took that man's wife." And Abimelech responded to that in verse 4. And he said, it says, "Now Abimelech had not come near to her, and he said, 'Lord, will you slay a nation even though blameless?' He said, 'Did he not say to me himself, she is my sister, and she herself said, he is my brother? And in the integrity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands, I have done this.'" He said, "He told me." So there's Abraham's little problem again with lying to save his own neck. And then God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this. And I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore this man's wife, for he's a prophet. And he will pray for you, and then I'll let you live." So Abimelech had to give the wife back. But God said, "I did not let you touch her. I restrained you from sinning against her." Does God have a part to play in helping us to resist evil? He does. If he helped a pagan, a non-believer in that case, don't you think he helps us? That he will help keep us from evil? I want to suggest that we need to give God a lot of praise when we resist temptation. And not take so much credit for ourselves. We're far too prone to credit ourselves for our accomplishments. And we need to recognize that if we overcome the devil, it is far more God's doing than it is us. Which leads me to my next point. And that is that we need to petition Him. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 13, one part of the prayer when Jesus gave us a model of how to pray, He said, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." You know, just before He said that, He said, "Pray, forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors." You know, if we didn't need forgiveness, then we probably wouldn't need to pray, "Deliver us from the evil one." But the only reason you need forgiveness is because you failed and you lost a battle, right? That's the reason we need to pray for forgiveness. And so anyone here not prayed for forgiveness lately? Well, then this petition makes a whole lot of sense. And it translates something like this. "Father, help me not to lie today because the devil is killing me on this. Lord, deliver me from my impatience with everybody. The devil's having me for lunch on this. Father, guard my heart against hatred. I don't like my boss. I don't like my sister. I don't like my neighbor. Help me not to do that. I'm losing the battle, Lord. I need you. Please forgive me and strengthen me for the next round." We need to pray. And I think, you know, to count the number of times that this petition came from your prayer last week is a good thing to do. How many times did you pray something like this last week? Count how many times you asked for forgiveness last week. However many times you asked for forgiveness is probably at least part of the number of times that you failed to ask Him ahead of time for help to resist that temptation. I find that I am far too inclined to operate on my own. No wonder we have to ask for forgiveness so much. And the last thing I want you to think of is just that God is faithful. He says in 1 Corinthians 10, "So if you think you're standing firm," this is New International Version, "so if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation is overtaking you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you're tempted, He will also provide a way so you can endure it." So He asks us first to realize our vulnerability, that we are vulnerable. He affirms that when we fail, our excuse that our circumstances are somehow unique and they're just an exception to what's normal, He said that's invalid. Because whatever it is, it's happened many times before to other people. Can you imagine God, something happened and you falling into temptation and sinning and God saying, "Oh, wow, I never thought about that one. I couldn't imagine a man being tempted that way. You know, you're excused from your sin because I just didn't think that could happen." That's not going to happen. God is faithful. He is in control of everything. And if God isn't in control of everything, how can we believe a promise like this? How can we believe a promise if He is not in control of everything? He limits temptation according to our capacity to endure it. And endure it doesn't mean that it's going to be removed, but that He will reinforce us and strengthen us to go through it, to remain faithful to Him. I think there's a lot of assurance there, and we need that kind of assurance. This passage John wrote to Christians who were needing assurance. He said, "We know that anyone born of God does not continue in sin. The one who is born of God keeps them safe, and the evil one cannot harm them. And we know that we are the children of God, and that the whole world is under the control of the evil one. We also know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding, so that we may know Him who is true. And we are in Him who is true by being in His Son, Jesus Christ. He is the true God, and He is eternal life." So the devil is an enemy to be feared, but God is a friend who can be trusted. And today, if you're not a child of God, then the Bible would tell you that you are under the devil's control in his kingdom. And that is a scary and a terrifying thing. And there's only one way out, and that is through the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul said, God sent Paul to people, telling him, "I'm sending you to open their eyes." We need to open our eyes to, if you're not a Christian, you need to open your eyes to the condition that you are in. Open your eyes and turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. Won't you do that today? You get out of the power of darkness and into the kingdom of His Son. You do that by arising and being baptized to wash away your sins. Why don't you do that while we're standing and singing your song?